It's an interesting story we're going to read today with about a solid 10 sermons that could come out of it. You're going to get the one I landed on. I'm going to stop a little bit along the way of reading this just to give a little explanation that I won't give in the sermon. Then an angel of the Lord said to Philip, "Get up and go toward the south to the road that goes down from Jerusalem to Gaza." That hears differently today, doesn't it? Than if we had read that sentence a year ago, 2 years ago, thinking about the road to from Jerusalem to Gaza. Parentheses, this is a wilderness road. So he got up and went, Philip, that is. Now there was an Ethiopian eunuch. I'm going to stop right there and tell you the rabbit holes you can go down to learn about eunuchs is wide and deep and full of information that should not be repeated in this setting, even though there's only one child in the room. What a hard life. What a hard life. I invite you down the rabbit holes, but I will just stop and say, I could never really find good scholarship that I was willing to dig far enough for. I'm sure it's there. I just wasn't willing to go that far. Sandy, you can fill us in some other time about it because I know that you know. What I couldn't figure out is why did people choose this for people? But a eunuch is a castrated man that is in the royal governmental courts because they could be entrusted to be around the harems, the concubines, the wives, without having any temptation to be intimate with all the wives and women and concubines of the rulers. So they castrated men to serve this role. So now they're outcasts. In some ways, especially in the Jewish tradition, they wouldn't be able to be a full practicing Jew, so they're outcast there. Now, this is an Ethiopian eunuch, so you've got race stuff going on with this marginalized person who is in charge of lots of important things, like all the women and the treasury we're going to learn here. Did I kind of get it? Okay, it's good enough for this. It's good enough for this. All right, good. It would not pass Sandy Rogers' history, biblical knowledge test in her classroom, but it's good enough for you all to just get caught up a little bit. So now you know what this is. So now there was an Ethiopian eunuch, a court official of the Candace, queen of the Ethiopians, in charge of her entire treasury. He had come to Jerusalem to worship. Now, I just told you he can't be fully practicing as a Jewish man, but he had come to Jerusalem to worship, and he was returning home. Seated in his chariot, which was probably a golden gilded chariot, he was reading the prophet Isaiah. Then the Spirit said to Philip, "Go over to this chariot and join it." So Philip ran up to it and heard him reading the prophet Isaiah, which would have been common for people to read out loud. So he overhears him reading the prophet Isaiah, and he asks, do you understand what you are reading? He replied, "Well, how can I unless someone guides me?" And he invited Philip to get in and sit beside him in the chariot. Now the passage of the scripture that he was reading was this: "Like a sheep he was led to the slaughter, and like a lamb silent before its shearer, so he does not open his mouth. In his humiliation, justice was denied him. Who can describe his generation? For his life is taken away from the earth." The eunuch asked Philip, "About whom, may I ask you, does the prophet say this? Is the prophet talking about himself or about someone else?" Then Philip began to speak, and starting with this scripture, he proclaimed to him the good news about Jesus Christ. As they were going along the road, they came upon some water. And the eunuch said, "Look, here's water. What's to prevent me from being baptized?" He commanded the chariot to stop, and both of them, Philip and the eunuch, went down into the water, and Philip baptized him. When they came up out of the water, the Spirit of the Lord snatched Philip away. The eunuch saw him no more, and he went on his way rejoicing. It reads on there that I've printed for you, but I'm going to stop right there. The eunuch saw him no more, and he went on his way rejoicing. You've heard the ancient story. We've been trying to do a lot of walking lately as we gear up for our upcoming sabbatical. I think it was about 2005 when one of our senior adult very special people lunches and program was held in Milford Chapel, which was then our fellowship hall when there was no gym, no community center. That was the first place I heard of El Camino de Santiago. A retired couple had just completed the 500-mile journey, a couple in town, not in our church. They had just completed the 500-mile journey beginning in France, up and over the Pyrenees, and across northern Spain, ending in Santiago. They showed some photos and told about their journey, and I was hooked. I just knew I had to do this one day, and I put it on my bucket list right then and there. Russ was not at this VSP meeting, but when I told him about it, it will not surprise you to know he was all in. 4 years later, we took our then 10 and 12-year-old sons on our first sabbatical experience, and we walked the last 100 kilometers, so a little less than 75 miles, thinking that 500 miles might be too much for them. The experience of walking that last stretch of the journey only made me want to walk the whole thing even more. So 2 years ago, 16 of us from church went back for the last stretch again, and that last stretch just made me want to walk the whole thing even more. 4 weeks from today, we will start our first mile of what will end up being more like 600 plus miles from the little French village up and over the Pyrenees, across northern Spain and into Santiago. And then we will leave Santiago and walk to the coast, which early pilgrims named taking the gospel to the ends of the earth. Another group of 16 will meet us on that last 100-kilometer portion, and then there will be a reunion tour from 2 years ago that has 5 returning pilgrims to join us for the last 75 miles from Santiago to the coast. This is a well-worn, well-marked path where thousands of people will journey with us. Yesterday, I looked it up, 2,614 pilgrims arrived in the Grand Plaza in front of the Grand Cathedral. We are not the only crazy people in the world. I'm just trying to prove that to you first and foremost. It's a holy moment when you arrive there. There are often tears. There are certainly cheers and lots of celebrating. There's a sensation of accomplishment, and I can only imagine for us this time, 35 days in, tired, sore, and exhausted, it's going to hold a lot of emotion for us. Bucket list items usually do. As an aside, this is a parenthesis. As an aside, thank you, church, for providing your full-time ministerial staff the gift of sabbatical. We do not take it lightly, and we do not take it for granted. We simply thank you for this time away to restore and re-energize and recharge, even if the way we restore, re-energize, and recharge is not understandable to you. Thank you for the time, for letting us intentionally participate in something that holds the power to renew our calling to come back and continue to be your pastors. Truly, thank you. We recognize so many professions deserve such time, and we are so lucky to serve a church that values this kind of experience for us. end parentheses. Yesterday, we set out from Kings Mountain, South Carolina parking lot and trekked to the backside of Crowder's Mountain, North Carolina for a 14 and a half mile training day on the Ridgeline Trail. There were some flat sections, but it was a lot of up and a lot of down, and I am real partial to flat. We got home and we were beat, but in a good way. Much like the Camino, there were plenty of people all along the way, families, dogs, singles of every shape, size, and color making their way in the woods. 7.5 hours of time on the trail gives one plenty of time to think. And I spent some of that thinking time on today's text. Now, I've laid out for you some detail of our upcoming Camino pilgrimage, and I've shared a short snippet of yesterday's training hike to simply say, there is nothing lonely, frightening, alienating, overwhelming, or scary about these journeys that I've just described. At least they're not for me. Tiring? Yes. Invigorating? Yes. Intense? Yes. And though much of the walk is in the woods, it's not wilderness. It's well populated, well marked, well within proximity to civilization. Though I certainly recognize that many people that will be on the Camino and that were probably in the woods yesterday are on their own wilderness journeys. But what struck me, all the things that struck me about today's text, and there's so much that could be said. Russ even suggested in his preaching outline for the year that this text is such a great story that could be taken in so many different directions. Call of God, ministry to the outcast, reasons people don't come to church, real Bible study, evangelism, baptism, so much. Take your pick. I picked none of those because I got distracted by the parentheses. I read the text multiple times through the early part of the week to see which direction was calling to me, and none of them honestly called to me, because at first, before I got distracted by the parentheses, I got distracted by how many commentaries talked about this story as a conversion story of the Ethiopian eunuch. How Philip converted the Ethiopian eunuch to faith. I just don't see that. The man had made his way to Jerusalem to worship God, which is interesting, since as a eunuch, he would not have been allowed in the temple. He would have been relegated to the outer courts, to the margins of faith practice. No matter what he did or did not believe, he would always find his place on the outside. But he clearly was a person of faith, making the trek to the holy city, and on his way home, he was reading the prophet Isaiah, wanting to understand more, which is where Philip comes in. He explains the scriptures to him in a way that enhances and increases the man's faith, so much so that when he sees some water, he wants to just jump right in and be baptized. It's from this story in the Bible where we get our closing words we use at every baptism. You'll hear them in a couple of weeks when we baptize one of our young adults. Look, here is water. What is to prevent you from being baptized? But I don't call this a conversion. I call this a furtherance of faith, a progression of faith, a continuation of faith. But it's not the baptism that is the moment of conversion. Baptism is an outward symbol of an inward grace of faith. This man was exploring, studying, seeking, asking questions, reading, thinking, moving, trying to understand more and better, interested in God. That is all the very definition of faith in my book. It's making me mad that Philip seems to be getting the credit for this man's salvation. When the man, I wish I knew his name other than Ethiopian eunuch. Isn't that the worst way to be described? The man had already gone to great lengths pursuing his faith, even as an ostracized outcast worshiping on the margins. Philip was able to enhance his faith journey with the story of Jesus, and the man was so receptive that he immediately jumped into the baptismal waters to proclaim for himself the good news that had been pulling on him and working on him for a long, long time. And the best news of the furtherance of understanding is that while he could have never been included in the Jewish faith, in Christ, he was set free to be fully included in the family of God and set free to spread the good news on any and every kind of road that he traveled. He went on his way rejoicing, the text says. The outcast and marginalized are always lifted up in our story of faith. Remember that. If you don't remember anything else today, remember that. So always, in every word you speak and every action you take, those on the fringes, those on the edges are the ones who are to be welcomed and accepted and included and loved. Be kind, and especially kind to those. So after I worked my way through that distraction, that's when I noticed the parentheses. Philip is called to go from Jerusalem to Gaza. Parentheses, this is a wilderness road. Why in the world would that detail be included parenthetically, almost as an aside, in the New Revised Standard Version of the text? Not all translations do the parentheses. Well, I've traveled down more rabbit holes on that one that I'll not even go into, so I'm just going to do some speculating. Here's what I know about wilderness roads. They can be lonely, dangerous, and full of pain, and they should be noted, even if only parenthetically, because wilderness is rough, and it should be named when you hit that road. Is it not a gut punch to see the words in our text, the road that goes down from Jerusalem to Gaza, in our current context of the atrocities in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? And conflict doesn't begin to describe the heinous and violent demolition of entire groups of people, the complete and utter annihilation, the hate, the violence, the despair happening upon all the people there, Jewish and Palestinian. If there was ever an example of wilderness road, wilderness times, wilderness situations, wilderness politics, wilderness living, wilderness dying, wilderness everything, it is the situation there. You may have noticed that we, Russ and I, have not spoken about it. I don't know how to speak to this in any way that is helpful, healing, or sometimes even hopeful. Tensions are higher around this topic, even in our own city, among our close friends who are Jewish and Muslim. Every single thing I can think of to say will hurt someone that I care about. That, in and of itself, is a wilderness road. The Camino and the Ridgeline Trail are full of people and signposts and help and beauty and bounty. The situation between Israel and Gaza is wilderness, barren, fear-filled, violent, devastating, hateful. Philip's job with this outsider, by race and outcast status, was to further explain, because every wilderness road needs more understanding. We see these wilderness roads in headline news, whether it's the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or the Republican-Democrat divide. Each side doubled down into their own long-held beliefs and opinions and strategies and action, and we, the more uninformed in the complexities of any of these issues, doubled down ourselves, picking sides and defending the most unbelievable ugliness that either side has to dish out. All the while, very few of them and very few of us are truly seeking any kind of understanding, which is what our text is pointing out to me today, the importance of seeking understanding. We would much rather spout off our side's position, and even better if we can destroy the other side with malicious rhetoric in the process. Everybody's guilty. Everybody's guilty. I can't imagine that there's anything I can say or do that can have any possible impact on these macro atrocities in our human condition. But I wonder if this text today might give us some insight into, at a very minimum, our micro wilderness roads. In the text, the Ethiopian eunuch, who was on the one hand in charge of the queen's treasury, riding in her in a gilded chariot, likely, the one who could safely be in charge of any of the harems, concubines, and all the wives, in addition to all the money, he was the outcast and on the margins, fully trusted, completely ostracized. And yet, he was the one who worshiped God and sought further understanding. The story is not about him moving from no faith to faith. It's a story about him moving from faith to deeper faith, richer faith, fuller faith that led him to a more complete adherence to God, understanding that Jesus was the fulfillment of all of God's intentions, and that now he could be fully himself and known as beloved in the eyes of God. From Mary Oliver's Wild Geese, whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting over and over, announcing your place in the family of things. The Ethiopian eunuch has a place in the family of things. The Jewish people have their place in the family of things, as do the Palestinians have their place in the family of things. On your wilderness roads, in the micro levels, we all walk them. Are you seeking more understanding? Or are you just doubling down? In every quarrel, in every misunderstanding, in every divisive moment in which you find yourself, those are wilderness roads, because relationships are broken or at the very least tense. And it is in the breakdown of relationships, the inability to talk to one another versus at one another, the choosing sides, the tearing down of another, that is what always leads to macro wilderness roads. How are we traveling our wilderness roads? With resentment and rage, with venom and hate, with malicious rhetoric, with divisive attitudes? Or will your understanding of the way of Jesus influence your tone? That would be transformative, wouldn't it? For me, for you, if just my tone were influenced by the way of Jesus? Will the message of Jesus impact the words that you choose? Will the call of Jesus affect your message? Will the understanding of what it means to follow Jesus persuade you to do the things that bring about good news on every wilderness road you walk? Bread for the World recently posted a sending blessing. It made me think that this was something that every parenthetical wilderness road could use. So as we go from this place today, from every Jerusalem into every Gaza, let these words be our guide. Because the world is poor and starving, go with bread. Because the world is filled with fear, go with courage. Because the world is in despair, go with hope. Because the world is starved for something real, go with truth. Because the world is weary of wars, go with peace. Because the world is not always fair, go with justice. And because the world will die without it, go with Christ's love. Do you understand? Deep, deep, deep down, do you understand the importance of feeding the hungry and walking in courage and living with hope and telling the truth and working for peace and justice? Do you understand? The world will die